This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
She believes that AFRICOM can play a positive role on the African continent. She supports its continued existence there. So again, we have to ask the question when these Democrats pose as progressives, and we're supposed to mobilize around some infraction suffered from the Republican Party. What do we get from this?
Black Alliance for Peace founder Ajamu Baraka on Ilhan Omar's removal from the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Apple has prided itself for almost 50 years of being the most secretive company in the world. When I realized I'm on the Superfund site with toxic waste and safety issues, and they're pressuring me not to even tell my coworkers it's a Superfund site, they don't want me talking to the government or the media, I start questioning all of this. And therefore, I reported all of this to the federal government.
Apple whistleblower Ashley Javik on being fired after complaining about the dangers of her building being on top of a toxic Superfund site in Silicon Valley.
Roscoe Van Zandt actually carried the American flag, and the workers were surrounding him. He led the workers out. So it was a demonstration, a visual demonstration to the rest of the workers that we are not going to allow race or gender to separate us as workers.
February 11th marks the 86th anniversary of the GM Flint sit-down strike that led to the unionization of General Motors. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has made a Democratic Party martyr of Ilhan Omar, Minnesota's Somali-American congresswoman, by removing her from the House Foreign Affairs Committee, where she had been vice chair of the Subcommittee on Africa. The congresswoman tweeted a lament that the African continent would lose its voice there with her removal, but Africans on Twitter responded that she had been terrible for Africa, most of all for the region she comes from, the Horn of Africa, and her native Somalia. During the devastating two-year Ethiopian civil war that ended in December, she supported the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a longtime U.S. puppet, and excoriated Ethiopia and its ally Eritrea. With regard to her native Somalia, she voted against debt relief and called for carrot-and-stick coercion to force elections which were engineered to remove the hugely popular president Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, a.k.a. Farmajo. I spoke to Ajamu Baraka, Black Agenda Report editor and columnist and founder of the Black Alliance for Peace, about Ilhan Omar's removal from the Foreign Affairs Committee. Welcome, Ajamu.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin McCarthy said that Ilhan Omar had to be removed from the House Foreign Affairs Committee because she's anti-Semitic and anti-American. But Ilhan and her supporters were quick to say that it was because she's a Muslim and a woman of color. I'd like to play a minute of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking for Ilhan and herself on the House floor.
Also, as a fellow New Yorker, I think one of the things that we should talk about here is also one of the disgusting legacies after 9/11 has been the targeting and racism against Muslim Americans throughout the United States of America. And this is an extension of that legacy. Consistency, there is nothing consistent with the Republican Party's continued attack, except for the racism and incitement of violence against women of color in this body. I had a member of the Republican caucus threaten my life, and you all and the Republican caucus rewarded him with one of the most prestigious committee assignments in this Congress. Don't tell me this is about consistency. Don't tell me that this is about a condemnation of anti-Semitic remarks when you have a member of the Republican caucus who has talked about Jewish space lasers and an entire amount of tropes and also elevated her to some of the highest committee assignments in this body. This is about targeting women of color in the United States of America. Don't tell me, because I didn't get a single apology. My life was threatened. Thank you.
Ajamu, what's your response?
Well, you know, it is quite clear that the Republicans have standards that such where racist people with neo-Nazi sentiments, anti-immigrant, will find a home in the Republican Party, and they will not face any type of censor when they are making comments that are proved to be harmful to sectors of the population. But, you know, and so does the Democrat Party, that they have been complicit in helping to whitewash the ultra-nationalists in Ukraine and to suggest to the population of the U.S. that we should have no concerns about neo-fascists in Ukraine. They are silent when it comes to the consistent violations of the rights and dignity of Palestinians. So the kind of hardboiled politics that tit for tat that we see in the Congress is not anything that is unexpected. But the one thing that we can't figure to be a mistake to try to reduce it to or characterize it as some type of struggle around principles and morality. The Republicans are retaliating from the treatments that they felt that they were subjected to when the Democrats were in the majority, when they did, you know, move against Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar. And Kevin McCarthy's been quite clear. He said that if the Republicans ever take the House again, that they're going to give the Democrats a little bit of their own medicine. So these are the kinds of games being played among these politicians that, quite frankly, I really don't get that excited about.
Okay, well, until the Democrats lost the House in November, Ilhan Omar vice-chaired the House Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Africa. Karen Bass chaired, but she left Congress to become the mayor of Los Angeles. And Ilhan no doubt would have chaired the subcommittee if the Democrats had won the House. As McCarthy rallied Republicans to vote against her, Ilhan tweeted, quote, "As the only African-born, not being on the Africa subcommittee is not just an elimination of a unique voice, but an elimination of the voices that have never been heard on a committee on the continent. It's racist, xenophobic, and discriminatory." What's your response to that?
Well, that's an interesting position. I mean, it's her position. I just don't think it has any substance. I mean, for example, we raised the question, what did the African continent get from her sitting on that committee?
Right.
What would it had gotten? We know that her unique experience as a African-born African may have been valuable when the Democrats were debating passing this racist piece of legislation, the Countering Malign Russian Influence Activities in Africa Act, something that reduced African nations to just to being in a position where basically either they had to be with the West or they would be subjected to punishment, including regime change. So where was the unique perspective on that to caution her colleagues in the Democratic Party that this was a backward piece of legislation? And we can go on and on and on. So she has not taken a forthright position on the expansion of the military footprint, the U.S. military footprint on the African continent. She's not been clear even about any of the politics in the Horn of Africa. So what do we get from someone because they claim affiliation with a particular kind of social identity? You know, we say at this point in 2023, time out for that.
Well, on the very same day that she put out that tweet claiming to be the voice of the voiceless continent on the committee, she tweeted a picture of herself with the new AFRICOM commander, Michael Langley, the second Black AFRICOM commander, and said how happy she was to have had a conversation with him about counterterrorism and diplomacy. And I got to say, I almost felt like I was on LSD or something. She didn't seem to perceive any contradiction. What do you think about that?
That's exactly what I'm referring to. That we've had a conversation with her on this AFRICOM question, and she seems to be in alignment with the goals and the objectives. She believes that AFRICOM can play a positive role on the African continent. She supports its continued existence there. So this is what we mean, that basically it's one's political and ideological orientation, not your particular social background. So it wasn't surprising that they have been silent on all of the militarism that we have seen over the last few years. So again, we have to ask the question when these Democrats pose as progressives, and we're supposed to mobilize around some infraction suffered from the Republican Party, what do we get from this?
Well, Africans made it clear in response to her tweet They piled on immediately to let her know they didn't think they were getting anything, neither in the Horn nor in the heart of Africa, where she went on a junket to Rwanda and then defended the president of Rwanda, ran PR for him despite all the years of war crimes in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and repression of his own people. She even voted against a resolution calling for the freedom of Paul Rusesabagina, the human rights activist Kagame has in jail. Anyway, there's another moment I wanted to go to. In 2019, Nancy Pelosi led a delegation of 13 otherwise Black congressional reps and federal officials, including Ilhan Omar, on a trip to Ghana, then to U.S. Army Africa headquarters in Italy. And the others on the trip were James Clyburn, John Lewis, Bobby Rush, Sheila Jackson Lee, Barbara Lee, Yvette Clark, Hank Johnson, Marsha Fudge, Karen Bass, Terry Sewell, Frederica Wilson, and Joyce Beatty. In Ghana, before they went to Italy to visit the U.S. Army Africa headquarters, they observed the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans landing in America and visited the Door of No Return, a monument to millions of Africans shipped to slavery in the Americas. Anything to say beyond that being another LSD moment?
Well, it is a moment of clarity in some ways, in the sense that these are individuals who have no critical awareness of the kinds of policies that they support coming from their government, the detrimental impact that those policies have on African people on the African continent, mm-hmm. and African people who have found themselves dispersed throughout the African world as a consequence of the activities of Western Europeans. They will support these policies, these imperialist policies. They will support domestic policies that have a detrimental impact on the Black working class. They are politically committed to the U.S. settler colonial project. And so, you know, this is nothing inconsistent with them going to Ghana and pretending to be concerned about the plight of African people on the continent and in the diaspora, while then simultaneously supporting policies that uphold the very same power that created that door of no return, that created the what we refer to today as the West. It was the plunder of Africa, the plunder of the global South that created the Western European powers. So these are servants of white power, and they will continue to be servants of white power until they are called out and until we have a movement effective enough to bring about some real accountability to these traitors of our people.
It seems just especially excruciating to see the race card played in defense of a white supremacist agenda, essentially in defense of these people who are promoting it.
That is what they do. This is part of the counter-revolutionary process that was intensified in the 1970s with the objective of, in essence, making the African in the U.S. an American. And the culmination of that process was the election, the ascendancy of power of Barack Hussein Obama. This is the basis of the confusion. The fact that you have the African-American community, the most critical community in the country, when it came to the issue of war and imperialism, now becoming one of the most conservative. And that shift happened under Barack Obama during those 80 years. I mean, eight years. So where we are, this is the role that these neocolonial servants play for the colonial project.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about this?
That we're not going to be, we're not impressed with the supposed outrage that is being generated because she was kicked off of that committee. Kevin McCarthy also kicked off Eric Starwell and Adam Schiff. Both probably should have been kicked off because of the way in which they weaponized these committees for partisan politics. So, you know, these are just political games. We watch them because they're important, though. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to be confused and caught up in the drama of these intra-bourgeois games among these servants of imperialist power.
You know, there's one other thing I meant to mention, is that list, the list who went to Ghana and Italy and visited the Door of No Return and so forth, many of them had background in the radical 60s and 70s. Bobby Rush was a Black Panther. Barbara Lee had some experience with the Panthers in Oakland. Karen Bass made multiple trips to Cuba as a young woman.
Yeah, but Karen was a Marxist at one point. She won't claim it, though. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I just wanted to add that footnote. So I guess we'll move on here and welcome you back to the States.
Well, thank
you're
you
on
so
your
much.
Way back from Columbia, right?
I'm coming back to the States, yes. For a while, yes.
Okay, thanks for speaking to Pacifica today.
Thank you, Anne.
That was the Staple Singers, I'll Take You There. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Apple whistleblower Ashley Javik was fired after complaining about the dangers of her building being on top of a toxic Superfund site in Silicon Valley. She went to OSHA and the EPA and discovered that Apple had captured these agencies and even hired former EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson to do damage control at Apple. OSHA officials, according to Javik, were actually colluding with Apple to suppress her health and safety complaints. She is still trying to contact Biden's U.S. Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh, about this internal corruption. Last week, she won an NLRB ruling that Apple had illegally attempted to stop her from discussing health and safety issues along with work issues.
So I have three charges with the NLRB. Three of them are about the retaliation. I face those have not actually had the decision of merit yet. The two ones that were decided on Monday were employee policies and not just, you know, vaguely some employee policies. I had filed charges of like my employment contract, Apple's NDAs, Apple's business conduct policy, Apple's policies about what is confidential information and what is not, whether employees can talk to the press, whether employees can post on social media. That I've posted on Twitter today, folks can go look if they want to actually see those filings. And I included the actual policies. So it's a huge chunk of Apple's corporate operations related to employment and labor. I also noted this terrible email that Tim Cook sent himself to workers on September 21, 2021, where he was criticizing that employees talked to reporters about a meeting where Tim Cook talked about things like pay equity and other benefits. And he claimed that any kind of thing discussed in an internal meeting is confidential and can't be discussed or shared, and that they'll hunt down anyone that leaks said confidential information. And these policies that I had sent to the NLRB also, Apple defined confidential proprietary information as anything non-public or vaguely business information. You know, these are, even when we have not so pro-labor leadership in our national labor agencies, these are the sort of things that like just don't fly. you can't tell workers that anything non-public is confidential. And if they were to share it, they would be terminated. Because that includes just basic work conditions, pay, that would reporting things to a government if you thought that something unlawful was going on. And Apple has operated. It's one of the, you know, these big companies where they like to keep stuff confidential, but Apple has prided itself for almost 50 years of being the most secretive company in the world. They actually like brag about not letting employees talk about anything ever that happens at work or they do at work or occurs related in proximity to work, right? I just saw someone posted, yeah, they tell us that in new employee orientation. And my biggest question to myself is like how I went along with it for almost 7 years, that I was just like, sure, this is normal. Like, it's just, you know, they would have these secrecy trainings where they introduce ex-CIA, FBI, NSA, and they tell us it's like working for an intelligence agency. and not just to not tell anyone anything. I mean, especially reporters, they say, but like friends, they teach you how to not tell anything to your significant other about work at all. They also tell you not to trust people. They tell you that we have whole classes on social engineering, that people will try to like manipulate you to learn anything they can about Apple. And I don't know, if someone was interested of like Apple's policies on COVID and really wanted to get that information for me, that does not seem like something anyone should go to jail over. Like, it's just, you know, it's just absurd. And they leaned into the absurdity as part of like their corporate culture. And as I went through my experience, when I realized I'm on the Superfund site with toxic waste and safety issues, and they're pressuring me not to even tell my coworkers it's a Superfund site, they don't want me talking to the government or the media, I start questioning all of this. And therefore, I reported all of this to the federal government. So we don't know exactly which parts of which policies that were found to have merit. They're working on a complaint. So the complaint would outline what specific things they're going to say, like, this is clearly illegal, you have to fix it. But there's things that I think are just, based on precedent, facially unlawful. So like saying anything non-public is confidential, you can't say that. And even Apple's policies that say like no retaliation or here's your rights, say Apple confidential internal use only on them. So like if you have a policy that says no retaliation, but it says internal use only, you couldn't give that to your union rep. You couldn't give that to the government. Like, it's like, you just can't do that. So I'm very excited to see what happens. I made it clear to the NLRB that I would not take any kind of settlement to withdraw. So Apple's either going to have to go to trial or they're going to have to settle with the government. And if they settle with the government, they're going to have to fix their policies.
How did OSHA intimidate a whistleblower who has valid health and safety issues? That's supposed to be illegal. And that's supposed to be their job to go after Apple.
I mean, they've tried to like dismiss my case three times now without investigating it or without explanation. And like, I've gotten so good at this now of like, I hear something like that and I'm like, hold tight. I'm going to do a FOIA request to see what you were just talking about with your man. And then I get it. And I'm like, looks like actually. And they're like, whoops. Okay. Nope. You're still here. We're still looking into it. So like, I have been in battle with this agency for over a year. Right. So when like the first time she tried to dismiss it, she's like, well, it sounds like, you know, you were unreasonable and there were actually no safety concerns. And I was like, send her this stuff. Like, did you read this? And they're like, oh, well, maybe that. Like, so they're like reading my employer's position statement, trying to gaslight me. The intimidation went really far. Like last year in September, I had escalated because it seemed like they weren't investigating anything. They'd already tried to throw out my case. FOIA results showed that they actually didn't investigate anything until I complained to the solicitor and OIG that November. And so I'm like, what are you guys doing? I want my case transferred. I get on this phone call and surprise, it's a deputy administrator for the entire region who's a naval captain on the phone. And he's like, don't record this. And then just like tells me I don't get due process. And, you know, it just is what it is. He calls a call like customer service, says they're just going to, I'll get a letter and I can have with my appeal options in 6 weeks. And I'm like, you're dismissing my stuff. You haven't investigated. He's like, well, you know, you'll find out when you get the letter. So they're trying to get me to withdraw my charges. Like some, and I'm like pro se. I mean, I'm a JD, but I'm not an attorney and I don't have an attorney representing me. And they get me on the call with an executive and a war captain to like, pretty much infer that like, if I don't withdraw my charges, they'll find against me. It'll be really embarrassing and I should just give up now. So I like documented that in depth in emails, sent it back to them and their inspector general office and to Marty.
Like, Marty aware of all this?
So I finally, our last call, I was like, if anyone can find Marty Walsh's email, I did get it. I spent a whole day calling around to every like Department of Labor agency I could find until I found one who like gave in and gave me this like email where I can get a hold of his staff. It took like 6 hours. So I finally email him and I'm like, I need you to know what's going on with this agency. And I've tried talking to OIG. They won't respond. Please help. And he did something. Like they never really responded, but OIG responded and said, we're not going to look into your claims of misconduct because we don't do that. I'm like, that's your job. And they tried to send me to the Office of Special Counsel. And Office of Special Counsel is like, we're for U.S. government employees, not you. And I'm like, OIG says they won't investigate though. They're like, and so I go back to OIG.
Office of Inspector Generals and Daryl Whitman, who was a former.
It's everything Daryl Whitman said. Like, and I brought that up in the Office of Special Counsel. I'm like, you may remember Daryl Whitman. Here's that report where you did a probe. I have evidence. And I told OIG, I have evidence to prove his allegations. And they said they don't want to see it. And
they
they're like,
I don't want to see the evidence.
And then whatever Marty Walsh did, they said they would like talk to headquarters about my request. I just want it transferred to an area that's less likely to be captured by Apple, like the Northeast or something, because I'm in New York now, that I can have just a fair chance without all these shenanigans. And they said they talked to headquarters. And then suddenly my investigators want to close my case. All of a sudden, they're done now. And I had a call with them last week. They did let me record this one because I said I wouldn't get on the call unless they let me record it. Dude, the last call. And it ended up being like 3 hours. And they just read my like employer statement back to me and had no knowledge of any of the evidence or filings I had made. They clearly didn't investigate like 95% of anything I sent them, but just sat there for like 500 days. And now they said that they will investigate all those things I said that would make me win my case, but I need to like resend it back to the same person who didn't read it the first time. And I can't complain about delays now because I'm asking them to relook at stuff, even though they never looked at it in the first place.
This systemic corruption, the cover-ups, it seems like for these agencies, government agencies, it's one cover-up after another. And you're slowly unpeeling it bit by bit.
I cry just as much as if it was a real onion too along the way. But, you know, I feel like I wonder how many times when you start doing this and you start pulling all those threads like I am, and a lot of this is public records requests of just, you know, once I get a lead, I'm like, I want to learn more about that, you know, going deep into Chevron SEC filings for a weekend where I was like, what did I do in a past life that this is now what I do with my time? But it gave me the key to proving not just like, I have a concern of conflict of interest of I have in hand proof there was a known conflict of interest with shareholder filings to the SEC at that time it occurred, right? So I think the more you get that where, you know, it's not just, I have a feeling, it's these are known facts and now they're connected in this web of corruption. As I was digging into Chevron, I also realized that Ron Sugar's on a lot of boards. So Apple, Uber, he thought that was a great company to take over. I don't know if you're like... Amgen, you know, the Northrop Grumman, he had been off of it, but I found through his 990s, his nonprofit forms or his whatever, he's was trading millions of dollars of Northrop stock in 2016 and 17. So when they sold to CalSTRS too. So like, you know, the more you can gather of this stuff and start piecing it together, what that recently led me to in the last month was a filing to SEC and FTC alleging something. I didn't know there was a name for this type of corruption. And I was weirdly reassured to know this is like a known thing, but it's called an interlocked directorate. And it's when you have enough boards of directors of huge companies where there's shared directors on multiple of these companies, that it's basically one mega board of directors with a number of huge companies. And the reason there's a name for it, and it's a known issue under antitrust laws, is because they've done research that the amount of corporate malfeasance, misconduct, fraud, bribery, general corruption is like exponentially higher when you have interlocked directorates. And the one that I documented, the linchpin for this enormous interlocked directorate is Ron Sugar and Apple. So I sent that to antitrust too.
A systemic struggle, which really is only going to be resolved when working people get together, organize collectively, and take the power from these bastards and criminals.
Make some noise. Here. Yeah. And thank you for doing that.
That was fired Apple whistleblower Ashley Javik about Apple's efforts to silence and intimidate her and other workers. To be free. Don't cloud your eyes with all those lies. That was Flora Purim, Open Your Eyes, You Can Fly. This year is the 86th anniversary of the Flint General Motors sit-down strike. UAW member Jean Anderson from Flint, Michigan, talked about the role of women and black workers in the strike and why the fight against racism is a fight for all workers.
My name is Jean Anderson. I'm from Local 599, Flint, Michigan, the Buick Motor Division. I'm here today to talk about the 50th anniversary where the women from the 1936-37 sit-down gave us permission to enter the parade as a marching cadre representing their struggle. I think sometimes people have a misunderstanding, though, especially the role of women during that time. These women were not only just supporters of the men that were sitting in the plants, but they were involved in many social issues prior to the sit-down, especially Janora Dollinger and Nellie Simon, who were actually the leaders of that. But they made a clear decision that they were going to stay in that fight as long as they could, because they understood that without supporting these workers, that it would make a difference in their lifestyles, the economics for the city, the future for their children. So their struggles were, you know, clear to them of what they had to do. When the workers decided to sit down in the plant, some of the black workers, or the majority of the black workers, decided to walk out because they really didn't feel that this was their fight. But it took people like Bud Simon to understand when he found out that Roscoe Van Zandt, because they didn't know really that he had decided to stay in the plant, that they would put him out front to unite the workers, because race was one of the things that they used in order to keep the workers apart. And not only that, but to undermine some of the efforts that the workers were trying to accomplish. So when they left out of the plant, we witnessed where Roscoe Van Zandt actually carried the American flag, and the workers were surrounding him. He led the workers out. So it was a demonstration, a visual demonstration to the rest of the workers, that we are not going to allow race or gender to separate us as workers. But I have to say this, that was a clear understanding that the workers understood, but sometimes the leadership would have to catch up with what the workers understood, because some of the leaders after that did not take on that same concept. And they started separating the women. They started separating the blacks. In fact, the blacks actually were, they did the sanitation work. And even though it was the best work, but they would consider that as something menial that only blacks could do. So, you know, yeah, the workers understood it, but the momentum sort of died along the way. And I think this is something that we would have to recapture in order to not come up with that same tactics.
The UAW used to play a much more important role in fighting racism. And do you think that if the UAW began to take the lead in the fight against racism in this country, particularly in the South, but all over, there's racism in every part of this country, that it would be able to change its organizing ability and link up workers like in the South, so that they would see the UAW as a vehicle to change the kind of conditions they have and the systemic racism going on in these plants throughout the country?
There's no doubt in my mind, because of the fact that that was one of the things that the UAW took a strong stand during the civil rights movement. They took, especially in the city of Flint, where places of business that refused to do business with minorities, they would boycott those businesses. And one of the first things that I could remember, that there was a bowling alley in Flint, Michigan, that actually would not allow blacks to bowl there. And the officers from Local 659 and 599 joined in together and went and not only boycotted, but demanded that shoes and bowling equipment would be rented to some of them, their officers that had been elected, black officers that had been elected. So taking a personal and a universal role in making certain that no worker, regardless of where you come from, whatever your ethnic background is, to understand that we are brothers and sisters and we are in this fight together. When they said solidarity, it did not have a question of race. It had a question of class. And as long as we understand that and stand together firmly, I think we could see another light for the workers in this country.
That was UAW Flint member Gene Anderson, who is participating in the 86th anniversary of the GM Flint sit-down strike that led to the unionization of General Motors. They will have an online event on February 11th with the documentary film Babies and Banners about the role of the Women's Brigade.
We shall not be, we shall not be moved. We shall not be. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved. The Union is behind us. We shall not be moved. The Union is behind us. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved.
That was We Shall Not Be Moved, Roll the Union On by Joe Glazer. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. A strike by a local of the Amalgamated Transit Union in suburban Washington, D.C. is now in its fourth week with pressure building. A Teamster local in another D.C. suburb recently voted to strike as well, although leadership has not yet called them out. Thomas O'Rourke of Pacifica Station WPFW filed this report.
Members of Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 689, are continuing to strike Loudoun County, Virginia's transit contractor, Keolis North America, despite receiving a last, best, and final offer from the company early last month. Now, in its fourth week, the ATU Local 689 members remain strong and solid in refusing to cave to company pressure while demanding higher wages and benefits. Keolis North America, a subsidiary of the French nationalized railway giant SNCF, Société Nationale de Chemin de Fer, received a $101 million five-year contract with Loudoun Transit in April 2021, when it underbid the previous contractor while combining the previously separate contracts for local and commuter buses. While the company claims its offer is fair or even generous, including an extra holiday on Juneteenth, the workers and their union claim that the company offers the worst compensation in the region, has cut benefits since taking over, and even forced a union recognition election when it refused to recognize ATU 689 as the workers' agent, losing that vote by a 96% margin. The union insists that it is ready to return to the bargaining table, but no date for the renewal of the contract talks have been set. I spoke to workers and union officials at both their picket line outside the Loudoun bus facility, as well as at an informational picket held at the French Embassy in Northwest Washington that called for the French government, as the ultimate owner to the privatized Keolis North America, to accede to workers' demands and settle this labor dispute. Virgil, you're a member of ATU 689?
Yes.
Why are you out here today?
Supporting the rest of the people that are out here, the rest of the operators and maintenance.
Okay.
Hoping to get a better contract out of this.
Are you a bus driver yourself?
I am.
Okay. How long have you been working in the Loudoun County transit system?
Well, I just started here in October. Previously, I was a big truck driver. I'm a Class A CDL.
Okay. So, okay.
When I left that 15 years ago, I was making more money than they pay these guys now. And that was a non-union shop at the time.
15 years ago. Yep. Well, you were a long-haul trucker.
No, I was all local.
Oh, okay.
I was an hourly guy.
Okay.
I drove for Old Dominion Freight Line.
All right. So you live in Loudoun County?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what do you think it's going to take to win this strike?
Persistence on the part of the people out here. They need to stay out here as long as it takes. I think the company will fold sooner or later, hopefully sooner.
Okay. Mr. Jackson said that the very few buses are actually rolling. You can verify that?
I haven't seen too many. Today looked like less than the rest of the week even.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how many went out today, but I think a dozen maybe went out each day during the week this week.
How many? What's normal with if
like
you were working?
60-something.
60. So it's about 20% of...
Yeah, if it's that.
Well, I guess they call that production, right?
I might actually be low on the number of buses that go out.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's way higher.
Okay. What are you all asking for, in other words?
Well, asking for a better wage, more fair to the area, better health care, obviously, and a better retirement plan. Me, at my age, I don't intend to retire from here, but there's others here that need that.
Sure, sure. But at this point, you can't even talk about those substantive issues because they don't, they're just playing mom, huh?
Pretty much.
Have they effectively locked people out?
Well, more or less. I mean, people here are eager to get back to work, I think. We would like to be negotiating. They walked away from the table, and as far as we understand it, they've been claiming that they can't negotiate. So, I mean, it's not true. Like, we're out here. We're ready to talk.
Yeah, they could pretty much call us anytime and say, let's go.
Yeah, okay.
They haven't done that.
What's your name, sir?
My name's Rob. I'm an organizer with the ATU International.
So it's not a lockout, but they did decree it. They had given a best and final offer, and if you don't take it, then...
Well, yeah, they did that. They've been sending almost, I don't want to say daily, but every few days they keep sending either a letter, or email, a text, something saying, you know, take this, ratify it, we'll give you $2,000. Somebody did the math, it comes up to like $1.50 a day.
Okay.
You know, hardly worth going back in for.
So they individually communicate to union members through your cell phones?
I get it through text and email, and they even send a express overnight to people.
Oh, for God's sake.
With a letter.
Yeah.
They're hoping enough people will walk away and go back over that, you know, they don't have to keep negotiating.
Mr. Jackson said a few of new drivers have been, you know, scabbing. Have they been, as far as you know, hiring new people?
I don't know about hiring. Mostly because they have people going around back and we don't get to see them coming in and out.
Yeah.
And they can't be, even if they're hiring, they must not be hiring CDLs because they can't put any buses on the road.
Okay.
Well, as we understand it, there were a few people we talked to early in the strike who were new hires who hadn't actually gotten their CDL yet. There were people who were trainees, basically. And I think that those guys really felt in a bind because they were hoping to get their CDL through the training program. So they have those people out on the road. You see that they've got some of these smaller buses, the cutaways, that don't require a CDL, and they're covering a lot of their local service with people who don't even have CDLs yet. And the bottom line is, I mean, they're trying to squeeze whatever they can out of people who go to work, but we know that nationwide there's a big shortage of qualified drivers. Wages have been going up in this industry across the board because a lot of companies can't hire. So I don't think that there's a large pool of unemployed CDL holders who are eager to come scab and accept the wages that Keolis is paying in order to, you know, try to drive down standards for everyone who's out here.
All right.
So there, I mean, if they could, they would be operating all those routes, but you know, they're doing a limited local service. Their commuter routes are shut down.
Silver line routes are shut down.
So they're really doing a bare minimum. And I think trying to cover the things that'll, you know, they'll protect them from like legal liability.
Okay. Okay. I talked to workers who were striking Washington Circulator a couple of months back. Mm-hmm. And they were at a picket line in town of Bladensburg Avenue. And they said, as well as a maintenance facility somewhere in PG County, mm-hmm. They said one of the things they're after is parity with Metro drivers. Is that, would you say that's a long-term goal for this?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Because Metro drivers, they're getting, what, $40 an hour?
Two, yeah, senior one.
Starting at about 26 or 8 or something like that. Yeah.
So we're even below that, because after like 3 years here, you're still not there.
Yeah.
You know, or you're just barely there if you're lucky at 3 years.
Okay, well, thank you, Virgil. Good luck to you, and I hope your union stays strong and solid and gets what you're intending to get.
Yeah, I don't think anybody we have out here right now picketing is going to go back at this point.
Okay.
And I don't know if anyone mentioned this to you. If you know, I don't know how long you're going to be working on this, but on Tuesday we're fixing to go to the French Embassy, since this.
Okay.
It's a subsidiary of the French National Railroad Company. So we're trying to get it on the French government's radar. It's exactly as President Jackson was saying. Like the standards that they maintain here would be scandalous in France.
Matt Girardi of the ATU, tell Pacifica Radio listeners why you and your fellow workers are out here at the French Embassy on Reservoir Road in Georgetown for the Keolis drivers in Loudoun County.
Absolutely. Not a lot of folks know it, but Keolis is owned by SNCF Rail, which is owned in turn by the French government. Keolis has since come over, and what we've been dealing with in Loudoun County has effectively been an extinction campaign. They have not, from the start, they didn't recognize us as a collective bargaining unit. They have made life difficult. They've cut benefits. They're not dealing with us in good faith. So we are doing our very best to go out here, send the message to the French government that having one of their effectively subsidiaries engage in these kinds of tactics is unacceptable. And I'm sure that they would never pull this kind of high-handed maneuver in France.
Okay. Well, they would have a fight on their hands for sure.
Absolutely. Even, we see how the French strike, and they know how to do it.
2 or 3 year raise in retirement, threshold is enough to get half the country out, huh?
Yeah.
Tell me, Keolis is a French company, but are there American managers here? Are there French managers? Have they sent them here?
They have.
And do they have a headquarters in this region?
They have a Keolis North America. I can't speak to exactly where their headquarters is. I know that they're spread all over North America. I believe that their biggest contract is in Boston, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they have a few garages in Reno, Nevada, for example. I know that they have a few other in Northern Virginia. I know that they're trying very hard to break into North America at this point. I can't speak to where their headquarters is, but I know that they're trying all over this country to break in and become a major transit company.
You know, it seems like it's a accepted standard pattern now for large companies or government entities to try to privatize through private contracts to get away from having too many government employees. How does the union in the long run deal with it? Is it just sort of one struggle at a time, or?
I mean, it is one struggle at the time, and we have to make sure that first things first, we get a contract out in Loudoun County. Because frankly, even if Loudoun County kicked Keolis out, we would be back to square one if they brought in another contractor, and we would have to renegotiate a union contract. So first things first, we're going to get a contract, and then we're going to move from there. I agree, though, that privatization in the long haul has been a disaster. We need to move away from it. We have to make sure that these workers are getting the dignity and respect that they deserve, and that so many of their others who are in public sector throughout the entire region are getting. We know that it's possible. We know that, especially out in Loudoun County, a county that has the highest median income of any county in the United States of America, that we can afford to do this.
That was Thomas O'Rourke reporting from Washington, D.C.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
That was Buffalo Springfield, For What It's Worth. In a recent memo titled, quote, February 2023 orders in preparation for the next fight, unquote, four-star General Mark Minahan wrote to his troops, quote, I hope I am wrong. My gut tells me we will fight in 2025. Xi, meaning Chinese President Xi Jinping, secured his third term and set his war council in October 2022. Taiwan's presidential elections are in 2024 and will offer Xi a reason. United States presidential elections are in 2024 and will offer Xi a distracted America. Xi's team, reason, and opportunity are all aligned for 2025. Unquote. On Fox News' Tucker Carlson Tonight, comedian Jimmy Dore had this to say about the U.S. provoking a war with China.
We have 400 military bases surrounding China since the Korean War. Do we really think that China is getting ready to invade the United States? Because I tell you, they're not. They make everything we use in the United States. Why? Because the same people who want this war are the same people who took the good jobs that are manufacturing jobs in America, turned them into low-paying, crappy jobs, and then shipped them to China. And then we get angry at them for the system that we set up. If they're so corrupt, because that's the thing, Americans have no idea how corrupt their government is. They think our government's just regular corrupt, like, oh, Trump gave his son a job, or Biden gave his kid a no-show job in the Ukraine war. That's not, the whole thing is corrupt. The $800 billion military budget is $800 billion of corruption. Why do we have to have 800-900 military bases around? We're the ones provoking this war, just like we provoked the war in Ukraine. We are now provoking a war with China. And what? Who benefits? I'll tell you right now. Their enemy is not China. Your enemy is not Russia. Your enemy is the military-industrial complex, which has been fleecing this country to the tunes of hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars. How many times are we going to have a defense secretary say, hey, we can't account for $2 trillion in the Pentagon again, that, like, which has happened twice now in my lifetime. So again, people are being the war machine cannot be stopped. Who's running this country? The war machine. It certainly isn't Joe Biden making these decisions. I would like to know who is making the decisions. And I just want to remind everybody, the United States is the world's terrorist. We just set the Middle East on fire in the last 20 years, and now we're doing a proxy war in Ukraine, which we provoked, NATO provoked, and it was just admitted that we provoked it by the former prime minister of Germany. And now we're trying to saber-rattle with China, and they're predicting a war. Again, China's not going to invade us. China's not our enemy. We might have an economic war. That's what these are. These are economic wars. These are wars for, in Ukraine, it's about liquefied natural gas and making sure Germany and Russia never come together, because we fear Russia's natural resources and manpower, and we fear them getting together with Germany with their technology and their capital. And so that's why we blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. That's why we're doing the Ukraine war. This is all about hegemony, imperialism, and economics. And if there's a Marine somewhere, it's there because they're about to steal some natural resources from another country. As everybody's screaming about what a bad guy Putin is for invading Ukraine, the United States is currently occupying a third of Syria. And which third is that? It's the third that has the oil. And how do I know we're there to steal their oil? Because the President of the United States said so.
That was Jimmy Dore speaking to Tucker Carlson. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the CRD Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.